this country, in 15 or 20 years' time, the black man will have the whip hand over the white man.
Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter!
I don't call it ratting, I call it an insurrection.
The whites have become black.
People have voted to leave the European Union, and their will must be respected.
Welcome back to About Race with Rennie Edo Lodge. In the last episode, I spoke to comedian Nish Kumar about who I am and where I came from. Feel free to listen back to it before you get stuck into this one. This week, I'm talking to him about my transition from blogger to author and how the world around me really affected that move.
When did you start blogging?
Oh, I think my first post went up maybe 2009, like political posts, because I've always been writing on the internet for my entire life.
Yeah.
Try looking for it, don't worry, it's been wiped. It's been wiped. Like my stupid rants of a 13-year-old brain, but political writing.
I mean, I would absolutely love to read some of that now.
Nobody needs to read that.
What sort of things were you writing about at 13? I do obviously want to talk about the political stuff,
oh,
but
God.
What sort of things were you blogging? What was getting your goat at 13, 14?
Pop music. And then in my late teens, Michael Jackson died. That was sad.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, stuff like that, you know, just whatever was going on in my head, basically.
So you just always written?
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
I always had diaries. And so then when the internet came by, I was just like using that. And like, I had blogs, or when it was MySpace, I'd write in bulletins.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was always. So it's like, it was very natural to me. And then when I started to care about things going on in the world, it was still natural for me to write through it.
Do you remember the first piece of writing you did? On the
political blog.
Yeah.
It was 2009 or 2010. And I had started writing for my student newspaper.
Right.
Because, you know, this is so ridiculous to say, but I was women's officer. I was chair of the Student Left Network and I was deputy comment editor of the student paper. And I was doing all of these things at the same time. But I was just like, well, I've got time, you know. And also, like, it was the kind of environment where, like, nobody else was doing it. So if somebody said, do you want to do it? I was like, yeah, okay, fine, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd written this piece of my student newspaper in, like, maybe 2008, 2009 called Is Feminism a Dirty Word?
Right.
Talking about what people think feminism is and what it actually is.
Yeah.
That was it.
It's still relevant now.
Well, yeah,
it's
exactly.
Still completely, the world has not moved on in 10 years.
And if you go on my website, you can find it.
For your listening pleasure, I dug up this post. It was published on the 25th of March, 2010. Here's an extract. It could be said that the feminist battle has already been won. Women have the right to a university education, access to high-powered jobs, the right to vote, the list goes on. But it would be absurd to suggest that women and men are now equal. What isn't absurd is to suggest that we still live in a patriarchal society. A society where young women are indoctrinated with digitally enhanced and airbrushed celebrities, told they're not good enough, and advised to spend as much money as possible to achieve perfection. A society that finds its young women overtly sexualized from an uncomfortably young age, and judged first and foremost on their physical appearance. In case you're wondering, yes, I was definitely that person having arguments in Facebook comments. This is always who I've been. I just try to reserve the strident nature to my work now. Back to Nish.
Do you think, I'm doing some COD psychoanalysis of you at that time now.
Okay.
Do you think like you were sort of trying to make up for lost time? Because when you were at school, you were sort of, you felt very kind of disincentivized.
Mm-hmm.
And now suddenly at uni, it's like, it makes total sense to me that you would try and do all of that stuff because you're finding an environment that you're supported. And
I think that like for the vast majority of my educational career, I was perhaps a high achiever, but it was very much taken for granted and not fostered in me.
Yeah.
particularly towards the end of like sixth form and stuff. So it makes sense that I was just trying to do too much when I was at uni, but I didn't struggle to. I just have time. You've got no dependents.
Yeah.
You live with people you don't even really like. You've got to keep yourself
pretty disgusting. It's not like nice to be at home.
Yeah, you've got to keep yourself busy. So
what did you, towards the end of uni, you start having that sort of conversation about what you could do afterwards. Did you have a specific goal in mind?
I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I knew what I was interested in.
Yeah.
I didn't really think specifically that I was going to be a journalist. But then after I graduated, you know, the recession had happened. It was a mess.
Yeah.
I just did a number of like short-term admin jobs while still being involved in activism and still trying to write. And at this point, like, you know, a little bit of Guardian exposure as an intern had given me the platform to be able to do a bit of tiny little bit of freelancing, but the pay was trash.
Yeah.
And that's a massive problem with the industry, you know, in terms of people who don't come from privileged backgrounds trying to get in. It's still really tough. So I was just doing these rubbish short-term admin jobs, my favourite of which was being a campaign intern at the Runnymede Trust, the race equality think tank. Yeah. Then I just ended up just going completely freelance because there was no 9-to-5 job available to me. So I just thought, I'm going to make my own job.
Yeah.
Because the world of work was not, didn't want to hire Rennie.
Again, this wasn't just happening to me. According to the Office for National Statistics, Britain's economic activity dropped dramatically after the 2008 recession. Economic stability was a myth. Even if you were established in your career, it felt almost impossible to get a foot on the career ladder. I remember claiming Job Seekers Allowance for a while after graduating. The most depressing part of it wasn't needing the money to survive, but dealing with job centre staff who treated you like dirt for needing the money to survive. Unemployment is compounded by race. Government statistics published in 2015 show that the unemployment rate for ethnic minorities was 11.3%. That's twice as high as it was for white people, whose rate stood at 5.5%.
By the time you decided to go freelance, you decided journalism is this is the thing.
Well, I wanted to follow the stories I was interested in. Let's just say that journalism didn't want me to do that. So journalism wanted to push me into like reactionary, angry black women response pieces about like cultural appropriation or this or that or whatnot.
Yeah.
And what I really wanted was the resources to find interesting stories and follow them and sort of like try and expose inequality, et cetera, which I don't think I really got. I didn't get those resources until I signed the book deal, actually.
Right,
I think my time freelancing, which has taken up the, you know, I've been self-employed now, it'll be 4 years.
Right, okay.
It was hard.
Yeah,
it was hard. The journalism world wasn't interested in these stories, wasn't interested in commentary about race, or if they were, it was only in a reactionary way.
Yeah,
it was frustrating. I'd argue with editors. The pay was totally pitiful.
Yeah,
it was difficult. I think it's something that I struggle with now, you know, now that the book's done well. The same outlets who couldn't care less about me 4 years ago are now like, please, please come, write
for
us. And I'm like, but I'm still basically writing the same stuff I was writing 4 years ago.
Yeah.
But now that there's a product behind it, you know, you want to be on board. So I'm like, well, I will take your money, but I'm not happy about it. I'm not happy about it, you know.
I always think that that period of time, a lot of us who do these types of jobs have that period of time where you're doing the terrible admin jobs. I always think that that's the thing that gets left out of cultural conversation.
Absolutely.
You know, everyone always talks about, you know, movies that are made about people we love. It's like the point where they suddenly become, you know, this amazing thing. We don't talk enough about, it's so hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's so hard for anyone, but especially the time period you're talking about where, you know, there's no jobs around. It's rough.
Nobody wanted me to write about race and feminism. But I think that like what I've learned now being in this sphere is that that hard slog is something that only people from working class backgrounds truly experience.
Yeah.
And that the cultural sphere is actually populated from people with from fairly privileged backgrounds whose journey has been far easier.
Yeah.
And that's another thing I struggle with as well, because I'm like, wow, fuck you, man. Like
let me quickly cut in with a much needed disclaimer. If you, dear listener, have benefited from private education, an elite university, class privilege, and/or knowing the right people, and you are currently working in one of the cultural or creative professions, I want you to know that this fuck you isn't about you as an individual. It is, however,
a fuck you to all of the above institutions, which, through their exclusivity, continue to reproduce inequality. Now, I wouldn't mind if they were just closed-off standalone clubs, but that's not the case. Instead, they appear to be prerequisites to creative success in this country. It's far from a meritocracy. Some people, especially when I watch people without that resource, and yeah. I know that I was one of those people without that resource, like, yeah. It's because it's tough, and you have to, I think I resigned myself, basically, for 4 years, barely saw my old school friends yeah. who would meet up multiple times a year for, you know, dinner and drinks. I could never afford to go.
Yeah.
I cycled everywhere. I took a packed lunch everywhere because I was just like, I am so dedicated to trying to get this writing thing off the ground yeah. that I would literally just reduce my level of outgoings to nothing.
Yeah.
And that was my life. And, you know, I was very lucky to have a partner who supported me through that because right. I couldn't have done it by myself. I'm only really like getting used to having a normal level of income now. I'm just like, wow. So I don't have to go around the whole high street trying to find the cheapest deal on porridge oats.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, it was tough.
What advice would you give somebody who's in your position as you were in then now?
Well, I think things have improved somewhat. It really depends on what somebody wants to write about. Mm-hmm. Perhaps have some savings before you go freelance. That's something that I didn't do. But I was never in the position to be able to get the job to have the savings in the first place.
Yeah.
Like, maybe I could have saved from my market store money if I can look back to my teenage years or like Saturday jobs or stuff. But yeah. Like this job as a writer has been my only like consistent career job throughout my entire adult life. I'm 28 now.
Yeah.
I never got the chance to have another career. The market was not conducive. The market didn't want me. So I would say keep going.
Yeah.
You don't have to go all martyr and self-sacrificial like I did.
Yeah.
There has to be some sort of happy medium, of course. Yeah, yeah. But like, you should never stop writing just because people are telling you no one's interested. You should never stop. The world didn't stop either. 2011 saw the London riots, sparked initially in reaction to the death of a black man, Mark Duggan, at the hands of police. What began as a community protest outside Tottenham Police Station soon swept the country in the form of the destruction of private property. In light of this, old, white, Cambridge-educated historian David Starkey took to BBC Newsnight to declare that the whites had become black.
I've just been rereading Enoch Powell, The Rivers of Blood speech. His prophecy was absolutely right in one sense. The Tiber didn't foam with blood, but flames lambent wrapped round Tottenham and wrapped round Clapham. But it wasn't intercommunal violence. This is where he was completely wrong. What's happened is that a substantial section of the chavs that you wrote about have become black. The whites have become black, a particular sort of violent, destructive, nihilistic gangster culture has become the fashion. And black and white, boy and girl, operate in this language together.
Starkey was gesturing to the writer Owen Jones while he spoke. His Owen on that moment. He pointed to you and he said, a great number of the chavs that you were talking about.
Yeah, of course, exactly. So it was exactly that. I mean, he used chavs in a, you know, without inverted commas, he was using it in a way to, and this was the thing, I suppose, what they were saying was white working class, I don't accept the term white working class youth, but young
people. White people who happen to be working class.
Exactly, have been corrupted by mass immigration and so-called black culture, as he describes it, has corrupted these working class young people who happen to be white, and that explained the riots. I mean, that was his understanding of it, is basically young working class people who are white have been corrupted by a nihilistic gangster culture, which black people are to be blamed for. It was racist and classist at the same time, of course, yeah.
A few years later, anti-immigration party UKIP swept up seats in the European elections, gaining 27.5% of the vote. I had to keep responding because I had this outsized belief that if I kept writing, I could change things. Which leads me to the book.
Everybody knows, really, that publishing is grossly underrepresented, as it is in most creative industries, and that was definitely on my mind.
The voice you're hearing is my editor, Alexa von Hirschberg. I'd asked her why, not long after UKIP swept up their 2014 election victory, she decided to take on the book that eventually became Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race.
Bloomsbury has always been, I think, far ahead of the game in terms of the books that we publish, the authors that we publish. I mean, we've published writers from all over the world. That's always been our thing, be it fiction and non-fiction. Carla Tosaini, Adif Suev, Romesh Gunasekara, Abdulrazak Gurnah, writers from all over the world, Jhumpa Lahiri. We've always felt that we've done a great deal to publish books and voices that, you know, we feel deserve to be heard. But obviously there's conversations that have to be had. You know, I was reading a lot of books from the States. We published an amazing collection of essays by Kiese Lehman.
I read that. It was called How to Slowly Kill Yourself and Others in America.
America, yeah. Brilliant title. And he's a fantastic, bold, inspiring voice. Roxane Gay, you know, writers like that. And where are the British voices here? So that was very much on my mind. When your book came in, I was joking earlier, it was called Colourblind.
Yeah, it's a horrible title.
A Journey to the Heart of Multiracial Britain.
Yeah, terrible title.
I mean, immediately it just struck me that your voice was bold. It looked you squarely in the face. There was nowhere to squirm away from it. It forced me, forced us to look at our communities and our workplaces. And I remember vividly, I circulated it for the meeting saying, I really think we should take this seriously. These conversations need to be had. And this is an amazing voice that could lead the charge, you know. And I just sat in silence. When it came to talk about your book, there was just a silence. Because I was looking around the table, 95% white people, and we didn't need to have the conversation. We needed to buy your book. We all knew that. But when we did eventually get talking about it, everyone said, this has totally changed my perspective. It was actually a really powerful moment because you know that something's hit a nerve when there's silence in an editorial meeting. Usually it's squabbles and fights. But this one, it was very clear that this had affected people deeply. So, yeah, I mean, as an editor, as a commissioning editor, your job is to convince people that this is a project to take seriously. Everyone was on board from the start, so that makes my job very easy. You had convinced people through your proposal.
Wow, I mean, I think, and it was a very bad proposal.
Well, I mean, I think people, I said at the editorial meeting, obviously the title has to change and it needs to be structured a little more. And I was actually reading back at some of the comments and people were, you know, worried about the anger, which is interesting in itself. And finding that balance, there was quite a lot of kind of more academic language which needed to be ironed out. But the core of it was that this is a book that's going to change the conversation.
I think I wrote that proposal when I was like 24. So it was like towards the end of 2014. And it was the first time I'd ever embarked on a project like that. And I was given a bit of guidance, but, you know, it was largely something I embarked on by myself. And so a lot of my information and research at the time, the space in which those conversations were happening were very academic spaces. And I found that in the journalism I was doing, I was like one of the sole voices attempting to push for a different perspective in journalism and media and really not getting anywhere, frankly. But I do remember coming in for the initial meeting with all of you at Bloomsbury and you bounding over to me in the reception, and like we'd already known each other for 10 years and be like...
That's publishing.
Yeah.
Darling.
And being like, wow, you know, this is really... changed all of our thinking. And I was so surprised to come upstairs into a meeting room where it felt like there were 10 different members of Bloomsbury Spath grinning at me. Like,
you know, I do worry about those meetings. I mean, in publishing, we always call it the beauty contest when authors go around different publishing houses to meet different people and you sort of feel like it's you've been judged. But you have to be overboard because ultimately, you know, we're representing your book. If we're going to be publishing it, you have to see that we're passionate about it.
Were you getting many submissions of this nature prior to mine coming in?
Every week I was getting books by young white women about feminism. Proposal after proposal after proposal after proposal. Very few books by people of colour, particularly about race. Behind the scenes here, yeah, we are actively looking for new voices, but underrepresented voices. That's part of our responsibility, it's part of our job. And there's a clear need for it. So we were looking for it. I wasn't getting a lot, you know. I mean, in the way it works, publishing houses is you have different editors. We have 5 commissioning editors here and each editor sees different proposals. So I don't know what everyone else was seeing. But what was coming to the editorial meeting was books about feminism. There were sort of bold, inspiring books about politics, but very few looking at directly dealing with race in Britain. It was like there was this strange amnesia, which you talk about in your book. And you talk about in the proposal to the book. Why aren't we talking about it? What are we afraid of? Do we think there's not a problem here? And that's why Colourblind is an interesting title for it initially.
Yeah, I mean, on reflection, a bit ableist. So I'm glad we didn't go with it. I didn't have a title for it. And it was you, actually, that suggested the title of the book as Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race, which was, and you suggested my own words back to me because it was the title of that initial blog post.
Yeah, actually, it was. I was having a conversation with the editor-in-chief, Alexandra Pringle, about the book. We were looking at books, you know, that made a splash. I mean, Chiesi's book, extraordinary title. Chimamanda's We Should All Be Feminists. They're a call to action. And Colourblind was just too soft and lyrical for a book. And your voice is so bold and inspiring. And also, the titles ask a question.
So it certainly makes people ask questions in their head. People take me to task every week about the title. And it's so funny because whenever anybody takes me to task, I feel more resolute, like, in my initial opposition. I don't feel the same strength of anger that I felt when I initially wrote that blog post. I don't, because things have changed for me dramatically. But whenever anybody attempts to take me to task without reading the book, I'm like, well, that's why I wrote that. That's why I wrote that initial piece, you know?
Exactly. This is it. It forces you. I think the reaction to white people, forcing white people to recognise their race, is very powerful. And as you write about, particularly in the new chapter in the paperback, it often gets a lot of strong reactions, as perhaps you'd expect.
So what do you think's changed since then?
Well, I think it's an extraordinary success story. Your publicity campaign was absolutely astonishing. Everyone wanted a piece of you, as you know. You can't deny that there's a market for these books, that people want to be having these conversations, that these debates need to be had. And people have stood up and taken notice, for sure. I mean, now I'm getting proposals every week about race. So that's my fundamental shift. And I do think this publication, along with a lot of other things, has had a lot to do with it. I mean, you look at The Good Immigrant. And The Good Immigrant hadn't come out when we acquired your book.
I know that for me and all sorts of different people of colour in the creative industries, one piece of feedback that you would always get is there's not a market for this. And it was maddening because you knew the people who would consume or engage with that work. And I feel I'm glad to say that both mine and The Good Immigrant have proved, yes, there is a market.
You know, I have been in meetings where people have said, oh, there's no market for this. But there was nobody in the room to say, of course, there's a market for this, because everyone in there is white and middle class.
I asked Alexa if she had any advice for those looking to change minds with words.
So for an aspiring writer, keep going. This is a great time for you to be writing. There are so many people that want to listen to you. If you have something to say, don't be afraid. Go for it. You know, it's important to find an agent, but just keep writing, keep finding people who are willing to listen, find publications. Don't take no for an answer. Just keep going. And in terms of people trying to get into publishing, there's a really useful website, both for writers and for people getting into publishing, called the Writers and Artists Yearbook, which gives lots of practical advice. Do a course if you can. Look at different schemes going on in websites, a lot of internships, most are paid now. There are also schemes that help people find accommodation while they're doing their internship. So check those out. Do your research, follow people on Twitter, connect, go to events, try and meet people. And this is an industry, you know, you need to get to know people, you need to get to know the industry. But we are desperate for voices, you know, for new voices. And I think if you're intelligent and passionate and committed, you'll find your place. You just have to keep going.
Before I met Alexa and the staff at Bloomsbury, I was used to being on the outside. I had ideas about what a literary gatekeeper might look like, might sound like, and what their priorities might be. I wasn't entirely wrong, but one thing that I absolutely misunderstood was that I had the power to change their priorities, which is why I'm so glad that I didn't give up. Even though I was close to it numerous times. I'm not on the outside anymore.
It's a weird thing for you, isn't it? Because you've gone from being, you were a critic of a system that is now trying desperately to co-opt you into it. And are you conscious of maintaining your outsider status?
Well, I think like every time I'm involved in one of these exciting opportunities, I'll always try to keep my critic glasses on. Critique the space. I was having a conversation with a friend about that Vogue shoot. Basically, the conversation boiled down to, I always tried to remember why I found myself in that place in the first place. And it was because the writing was radical. So I'm not going to start getting gassed when I'm in that space. Like, oh yeah, I'm here. I'm not there for any other reason. I'm not there because I'm a model. You know, I'm not there because I'm, you know, a hair stylist or a photographer. I'm there because I wrote that book. So That's the only reason Vogue wants to take a picture of me.
Yeah.
So I have to remind myself of that and not get carried away, I think.
Yeah,
it can
yeah.
become very seductive. But I, for the majority of my life, I've been outside of those spaces.
Yeah.
I never really worked a 9-to-5 in journalism. There was nobody in my immediate family when I was growing up who worked in the creative industries at all, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I really don't want to take my position for granted here. Like, it's not... I recognise this is just not normal for somebody of my background, and so I shouldn't treat it as though this is my new normal now.
We're doing something new on About Race, which is using the platform to signal boost other podcasters who are doing excellent work. This week, I'm going to be shouting out Podcasts in Colour. This is a podcast about podcasts hosted by people of colour. Berry, who hosts Podcasts in Colour, is an incredible supporter of podcasters of colour around the world. So definitely tune into Podcasts in Colour if you feel like your subscription list is looking a bit too white. About Race with Renny Edo-Lodge is written by me, produced by Renee Richardson. Our researcher is Res Marino, and our research assistant is Isis Thompson. Original music is by Matt Sibiso, and artwork is by Kevin Morosky. Additional help was provided by Laurie Penny. You can join the conversation using the hashtag AboutRaceWithRenny. Full transcripts and episodes are available on our website, aboutracepodcast.com. If you like what you hear, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to the show on your favourite app. This podcast is funded by Arts Council England. Thanks for listening.